Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This episode is brought to you in part by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Did you know you can get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today? And all you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/investor.
This podcast was brought to you by LivePerson.com. LivePerson.com, a world of experts.
Hey, welcome aboard. This is episode number 87 on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here, and I am the host, talking about investments, money, finances, all sorts of stocks and bonds and mutual funds, ETFs, everything in between. Trying to do my best to keep us all ahead of the pack and, number one, safe with our money in this very unsafe time. And number two, making money when the opportunity does arise. So hopefully you've been following along at home and doing your homework and learning as much as you can between the podcast and MSN Money, where I write, as well as the Strategy Lab, of course. We put a link right on the website for the Strategy Lab, right? Some people said that we didn't have a clear enough link there and did some work on the disciplinedinvestor.com as well, to make it easier for you to find a few things. Lots of audio up this week from the Money Show. I talk about the mutual fund situation, the auto industry, some other ways and to make sure to just keep your portfolio from dropping off a cliff in this environment. That's all on our site that we have links to that's right now up on MSN Money video site, as well as the Money Show. And hopefully you're going to take the opportunity to visit me in Orlando and we can get to know each other and spend some time. We had a great time in D.C. at the Money Show with a bunch of disciplined investors. And I think that was in December or November. Or maybe it was December, actually. Oh, no, it was definitely November. Got to get my month straight here. Things are moving very quickly. I thought I would just start off a couple different things today, and then we'll get to our guest, John Markman, who is a brilliant fellow. His work is the work that you need to be watching for, reading, listening to as much as possible, but he's the kind of guy that can make sure to get you ahead of the curve. But before we got to that, I just wanted to talk to you about a few things. We got a tremendous amount of responses to last week's discussion with Tim Sykes, and we'll have the winners for you next week on that. And I also wanted to mention to you that it's really important right now for you to think about looking at your mutual funds, if you own any, even though they're down this year. Many of them have been doing something that is really a little, well, disappointing, but not unexpected. And they're passing through capital gains because, during the year, they've had to sell a lot of positions off. And even though, obviously, they're down this year, many of the positions that they sold off had low cost basis from years and years and years ago. And what happens now is that because there was forced liquidations and this requirement to sell because of withdrawals, there is a tremendous amount of capital gains that have been built up. So I want you to do yourself a favor. If you have mutual funds, contact the company, or if it's at a brokerage house, contact the brokerage house and see if they have any insight into what the mutual fund distributions are. And maybe you can do something possibly if it's the right thing to do. You may want to potentially do some planning and taking some capital losses this year, if that is the case, to offset them, because there's nothing worse than having a down year and having to pay taxes from your investments on top of it. That is quite ugly, I think. That's not a pretty sight. But I also wanted to talk to you about, there's a lot of things in the news right now. There's something that's really that has hit the headlines, and I'll probably talk to John about this. It's very disconcerting and really troubling. And let's just bring it to its very essence, in that it appears that a legend of the financial industry, and frankly, I'm rather embarrassed to be these days to be associated with this industry, with all that's happening, because this gentleman, Bernie Madoff, who was in the business for the last, 30, 40 years, and one of the originators of the NASDAQ markets and sat on many different boards and really has been held in high esteem by his colleagues and in the industry, hedge fund manager. It seems that he stole money. It seems that he stole $50 billion. And I'm sure you've been reading about this, whether he stole it or lost it or misplaced it or whatever happened. It's a real bad situation because the names that are coming out, and more so not the names, but the amount of money that's involved here is pretty serious. And I'm real curious how this is going to trickle down into the economy. I will tell you that this is one of those very clear occasions that just brings us to say, you know, if it looks too good to be true, well, it probably is. But more so, and more importantly, you know, never, never, never let your guard down, because that's just the time when we think that everything is on autopilot. This is a gentleman who supposedly was providing 10, 15, 20% annual returns for years and decades. And there's a lot of leverage that went into what he did, because there was such a feeling that he could do no wrong. And there was this, just a total disregard, once again, for risk here by some very affluent people. And I'll tell you the real problem. Something seemed to have slipped through, a $50 billion slip by the SEC and maybe the New York powers of enforcement, maybe the NASD, and really just a very troubling, and very sad situation for investors overall. But what we did was, I want to see really where this was centered. We went to Google Trends, and we put in his name, and we found the greatest concentration of requests for his last name, Madoff, was from Switzerland, which was interesting. I guess there was a lot of Swiss bank accounts with money in his investments. Second was New York, and then the New Jersey, and I think Florida. There's supposedly a lot of investments in the Palm Beach area that was involved there. Really kind of very, very sad. We also just want to mention on a second note before we get to John, is that if you have been in this market wondering kind of where we're going, what we're doing, and particularly with the strategy that we've had a very slight portfolio position for some time and still doing well, because we've been bouncing back and forth, right? We've been buying on the lows as many prices come down and the markets have been screaming on the downside. We have a lot of buy orders in much, much lower than the current market, and they hit and they go up, and then we have a sell stop on the way out and it keeps on trailing up. So what is happening really is that we're making some money in the strategy lab and in our portfolios for our clients on these swings. We've also did some great entry into the materials areas. I think that's going to be a good play. We'll talk to John about that, I think, too. But other than that, I'm still remaining quite bearish on the markets, and I've been getting a lot of emails from you. Thank you. But this is no time to let your guard down right now, even though it looks like things are a little bit brighter. Economic numbers are really difficult. Pay attention to that. And let's see what happens with the Fed, if they're going to reduce rates or what they're going to do before the end of the year in some type of Hail Mary approach, I guess, to the market condition. Anyway, with that, let's get on with the show. We'll be right back talking with John Markman on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Hi, I'm David James. I'm an expert to the world
in spirituality.
There are millions of experts who are brilliant in the kinds of things everyone needs answers to.
Hi, my name is Larry Doan. I'm an immigration lawyer in Los Angeles.
Now you can chat with them live, online, and benefit from their knowledge.
Hi, I'm Jamie Parker, a public relations specialist and an expert to the world on liveperson.com.
There's a world of experts on liveperson.com. Chat live. It's free to start. Liveperson.com, a world of experts.
And I thought before we began with this today, we'll just go right into I think the personal development is really important. And before we get to our guest today, John Markman, I thought I would just mention to you that, you know, the special offer, but we're, of course, as you know, sponsored by Audible. And they have a special offer where you can get a free audiobook download. And next week, we have Peter Schiff coming on, who is one of the select few that is always talked about as the gentleman who called this market decline. He has a book out called The Little Book of Bull Moves in Bear Markets. And it's really it's all about how to keep your portfolio doing well in hard times. And it's actually on Audible. And I thought maybe in light of the fact that he's coming on, it would be kind of cool if you could listen to his audiobook before he comes on, maybe send me a question or two that you have for him, and then you can get that answered. And all you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/investor. And of course, we'll have a link on the site for that. And but this is a really cool thing. You just go, no obligation, just go on. And I love it. I mean, I'm a talk radio, talk show, podcast, audiobook kind of freak, I guess. I just love listening to on my iPhone all sorts of information. It's just not enough. It's kind of like these days, yeah, it's like trying to take a sip out of an open fire hydrant. But I just think it's wonderful, the opportunity to learn things. And what better way than to, you know, be able to multitask, because you can listen and at the same time you can do other things. So Check it out, The Little Book of Bull Moves in Bear Markets, Peter D. Schiff, and that's available on Audible. You go to audiblepodcast.com/investor. So let's get on with a discussion with someone who I think you're going to very much enjoy. We have a good friend of mine, John Markman, and he is a writer extraordinaire, writes for MSN Money, has a terrific, and absolutely, we'll tell you more about this in a minute, but a terrific newsletter, a market letter that he puts out, and he'll tell us more about that. And he quite accurately predicted many of the things that have happened this year and have really been disturbing to these markets and have been pretty negative. But we're going to get some of your hopeful insight to 2009. So, John, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
So,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So, let's kind of just go forward, then we'll come back a little bit. So, 2008, you saw a lot of the things that are happening. As a matter of fact, your recent article on MSN Money was talking about some of the warnings that you put out early in the year and were so, I think, very accurate with many of them. What's now? We're in a weird phase right now, this kind of intermediate time when it looks like there's a little bit of the sightings of maybe there's something, a silver lining, if they say, on the horizon of with a lot of bailouts and the market starting to open up a little bit. But yet at the same time, the economic news that keeps coming out is just horrific almost every single day. So what's your take on this whole thing?
Well, I see the beginning of 2009, and to be very similar to the beginning of 2008. At the beginning of 2008, there was a lot of hope that the government would be on the solve all of the problems that existed in the credit markets at that time. If you recall, we still had Bear Stearns, the Lehman Brothers were still alive. Merrill Lynch was struggling, but it was coasting along. Washington Mutual, Citigroup, et cetera, were coasting along in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And there was a lot of hope that the Treasury Department and the Fed were going to get this cycle right, that they were going to open up the floodgates of money and all the money that the Fed would make available through its normal monetary methods, which is to say cutting interest rates, would make the problems go away. But, the optimism only lasted about a day in January.
Yep.
And the market fell straight into pretty much straight for the next down for the next 3 weeks. Then there was a little bit of optimism, and the market then fell again until March and the bailout of Bear Stearns. Once the government bailed out Bear Stearns, there was a lot of, by encouraging it to merge with J.P. Morgan, there was a tremendous optimism that, well, the government may have been slow to this thing. It took them 3 months to figure out what the problem was, but now they've got it solved. And that optimism lasted for about 2 months, right up into May. And from a technical point of view, the optimism lasted until the market had risen up to its 200-day moving average, very simple average that a lot of technicians look at. And once that level was hit, boy, the sellers came back in a hurry, and they just slammed the market right back into July. In July, the government came along and said, you know what, we've been a little bit remiss here. We made a mistake, and we're going to support Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the market lifted from there into August. And by mid-August, people were feeling pretty good about things. The S&P, it's hard to remember back this far, but the S&P was only down about 8% in August. Mm-hmm. And people were feeling that we were going to have a nice end-of-the-year rally and the markets would be just fine. But then the Lehman Brothers got into trouble. And for some reason that really escapes most of us, the government decided to let Lehman Brothers go. And that created a disaster, obviously, that lasted into October. But finally, the government looked like it got its act together, and through a series of new bailouts actions, it looked like the market was going to recover, and it began to recover until November. The optimism lasted about, what was it, Andrew? About 3 weeks that time?
At most, I would think that's about that, but yeah. But it was not total optimism, right? I mean, that's why it lasted only a short time. It was kind of it was skeptical optimism.
Exactly. Well, it looked like there was a lot of optimism that, boy, the government might have dropped the ball two or three times already, but this time they really got it right.
Right.
And they've been shocked into submission. And then the S&P fell another 100 points back into the 2002 lows. Mm. And right on that technical line, and there's no reason for the market to have stopped there other than the fact that, you know, technicians believe that that was a line that would be defended by the government. The S&P then rose about 150 points to where we are now, just below the 900 level. And if you think about it, you know, there's really nothing has changed. Right now we're going into the new year thinking, boy, the government may have screwed up four or five times now, but darn it, this time they're going to get it right. And, you know, I just have to wonder about whether they really are. Now, the reasons for the optimism are a little bit different. The optimism this time is that the new Obama administration will bring in new, more competent management of the Treasury.
Well, that's not a hard thing, but go ahead.
But then you look at exactly who they're bringing in, and the gentleman who's going to be heading the Treasury is one of the gentlemen who was part of the decision to let Lehman Brothers go, Mr. Geithner, formerly head of the New York Fed. And it gets a little scarier when you consider that the New York Fed has traditionally has been considered to be the risk manager of the United States financial system.
Mm-hmm.
And here's this guy who by all accounts, you know, you look at his biography, he looks very competent. But at the most critical time in our nation's economic history, perhaps, certainly in the past couple of decades, he contributed to making a very, very wrong decision. And yet the investors at this point are giving him a pass, saying, well, he probably learned from that mistake.
Well, so, he was on the job also. Let's not forget, he was also on the job during, well, obviously prior to all the problems, which then you have to question how all these problems happened and how they went unnoticed, particularly starting with Bear Stearns. I mean, he was on the job there too.
And Geithner, going back to the middle part of this decade, he was the Treasury's man in Japan, advising Japan on how to accomplish quantitative easing there. And the program that he was a part of there really did not succeed whatsoever. And Japan, you know, has lingered in an 18-year recession. You could call it an 18-year depression.
Let's be optimistic for a moment, and let's say that while we may not like all of the picks, let's just say that maybe if nothing else is a psychological optimism, and it really can't get much worse than what we have right now. And that being the case, is it possible the government has any of this right at this point?
Well, what the government is planning to do is to just flood the zone with money. So basically they're planning to try to solve a problem that was created with borrowed money by borrowing even more money and taking that money and buying. Their first idea is to repair the infrastructure of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the surface, that sounds kind of good, you know, but when you really look at it and what they're planning to do, all they're really planning to do is fix a bunch of rinky-dink roads around the United States.
Light bulbs. Did you hear about the light bulbs?
They're going to replace all the light bulbs in federal buildings?
And in the schools and in the hospitals, because they are going to be more energy efficient. That was the big plan. I'm not kidding.
Plan. I've looked at the list of projects that they're looking at, and to me it looks like a bunch of road paving and, you know, patching up of some dams and whatnot. And I just think that, you know, the states and cities are already starting to squabble over whose projects are more important and which projects should be done first. And the thing that bothers me is that the things that are ready to go first are really not the things that will propel, that will really provide the greatest investment for the future.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I'm afraid that while there's a lot of optimism that the new infrastructure spend is going to help the economy, I think we're setting ourselves up for a new level of disappointment.
Well, first of all, the disappointment is going to take a long time. We won't see the disappointment for a long time. This is not going to be a quick fix. Even if you say today, okay, go, I mean, then the states have to agree. There's this use it or lose it plan, use it or lose it rule, that if the states don't use the money, they're just going to lose it, which I find that to be an interesting situation, because what happens if the states are pressed to make decisions and they don't make it? You know, it takes a long time to do, engineering and to have civil engineers out there making sure they know what the plans are. And most I would think that many states do have plans, and they possibly have been working on this for a long time, at least specking out what they have to fix. The fact is that many of them didn't know that they were going to be getting this kind of money, and maybe rushed.
It reminds me of the old Ronald Reagan phrase, which is that, you know, if anybody ever tells you that the government is here to save you, that's usually the scariest phrase in the English language. And to ask them to save you quickly, that's even more scary.
Mm-hmm.
Because quick fixes in government are usually the worst. You know, I find it interesting that, and possibly just coincidental, but let's just say it's interesting, that the corruption scandal in Chicago comes along at exactly this time. And you can see that, you know, the nexus between government and contractors is just a very dangerous place to be throwing a lot of money. I think what we're really setting ourselves up for is to throw a whole lot of money into a situation very quickly that could lead to a lot of waste, lot of corruption,
so,
and finally a lot of disappointment.
So you have, I mean, these decisions, by the way, not to mention the fact that the Treasury spending $350 billion in such a hurry. And you know, did you see that Bloomberg was denied the opportunity to see who was given the $2 trillion from the Fed? They had sued the Fed to try to, through the public access laws.
The Fed is saying, trust us.
Right.
Yeah. And to me, I think we can draw a parallel to the recent scandal over the disappearance of $50 billion from the investment funds of Bernard Madoff. Because Mr. Madoff, his comment to anybody who asked how exactly he was doing what he was doing was, trust me. And, you know, secrecy is really one of the old standby methodologies by which the government tries to prevent citizens from understanding what's going on. But this is really not a good time for secrecy. This is a time for transparency.
Right.
And the fact that the Fed and the Treasury are preventing Bloomberg by, you know, by extension, the citizens from understanding how they're spending the first $350 billion spent on the bank bailout portends very, very poorly for the spending of all this infrastructure money to come.
So if you were to just look at just the points here of that we have a very, you know, we have this flood of estimates are anywhere from, I don't know, $5 to $8 trillion of current expenditures between bailouts and monies that have been put out by the Fed and just the enormity of enormous amount of money out, you know, that was put out. Now we have the potential for auto.
I'll just caution that those high numbers, those aren't really the amounts that are spent. A lot of that includes guarantees.
Correct.
So if, for instance, you know, you have a $2 trillion program by the Fed or the Treasury to backstop commercial paper, it doesn't mean they're actually buying $2 trillion worth of commercial paper. They've promised to backstop that amount.
Right, and the likelihood of it all going out is very, very slim and very remote. But so even if our number right now is $2 trillion, if you add up, the TARP, not all that spent either, but, you know, we're getting somewhere in that neighborhood. We know that, you know, something's happened with the Fed with $2 trillion. That's what that they were looking for from Bloomberg. And we know that the money from the TARP plus any other monies that was spent, I mean, it's pretty significant. Even Citibank was a guarantee, though. I mean, there was 20 or 25, I think it's $20 billion that was put on, and then guarantees.
Right.
So.
And you're saying that it should have, you're saying, gosh darn it, it should have some effect.
Well, I don't know about that. What my concern is.
I think that's really the, you know, when you look at the bull's argument, and I would, by the way, I'd love to be a bull. I don't like being bearish, and I don't like being negative on the prospects for America. But I'm just trying to be realistic here, and I'm saying, how do we really know that this money is going to be effective? And how do you know if it hasn't been effective so far? We haven't obviously seen any turnaround in the earnings of major companies. Then I think we have a hard time believing. You know, we're only taking it on faith that it's going to work.
Well, I can give you proof how we know it's not going to work.
My problem with the money that's being spent is that, you know, ultimately for stock prices for all this money to have an impact on stock prices, you have to create high quality jobs and high quality earnings that are persistent. And that is what I think is really lacking at this point. You know, doing a bunch of interesting, you know, rinky-dink, road repairs and dam repairs and fixing light bulbs does not create high-quality jobs and does not create, you know, high-quality earnings going forward for American companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a challenge.
Well, I mean, it may, though. It may, in all fairness, it could provide a bullish atmosphere for a very select group of companies, some of the material companies and engineering firms, and maybe, who knows, maybe even GE with energy-efficient light bulbs. But, I mean, you could get that select group. But put that aside for a minute. What you're saying is the rest of it, where is it going to trickle out to? Where is it going to create long-term impact for our economy that seemed to have dropped off a cliff in October and doesn't seem to have any sense of climbing back up at this point? And I think, John, the answer to whether or not we can have confidence in the current state of our economy and belief that it's going to recover and that the money spent is going to be used is very simple. All we have to do is look at the confidence that the Fed, the Treasury, and any of the other economists on a government basis has, because they wouldn't continue to do things at this point, more money in, lower rates, if they felt that what they've done already will have the effect long-term or even short-term. So by further moves and further money into the economy and flooding it with excess liquidity and all that, I mean, it's obviously not working, and you can't, I don't think you can have faith in it right now. And also one other thing, the opportunity to be a bull right now, I mean, a real bull, I'm talking about just, is could get you really hurt. But the other side of it is by being bearish or cautious at this point, at least, there's this big argument that you'll miss the next big run-up and all that. But at the same time, it is apparent that every economic number we see and earnings that we see is flashing a warning sign.
Well, the bulls will tell you that, the biggest reversals, during recessions come when the economy looks the bleakest. And, one of the reasons that the market rallied a couple of Fridays ago on the worst unemployment number seen in 30 years was that old-timers remember that the last worst jobless report came in December 1974, which was the turnaround, which was the very month that the 73-74 bear market turned around. So everybody knows that the economy is going to look bad when the market turns, and they're trying to. And the question is, at this point is this really the very bottom of the recession? And if so, you're going to want to start applying money now. Mm-hmm. That's the time to take risks. But the answer, the way you answer that question is to look forward and say, what is the likelihood that this is the bottom of the economic catastrophe that we've experienced recently?
Mm-hmm.
And when I look forward, I can see it's very hard for me to perceive of the economy turning around in June of next year.
Mm-hmm.
Which it would have to do in order for this to be the bottom.
Right. So let me ask you something. So let's go. You have so everybody listening, I want you to tell you that
let me backtrack one second.
Okay.
So on the other hand, I have to, as I told you before we started today, I'm a little torn because it is possible that we could see a mild turnaround in June of next year, in the second quarter of next year. If the Obama team at Treasury and Fed really are able to push out, $400 billion out the door, and it really starts being applied to companies, and companies start to hire again, and people start to have confidence in the fact that they can buy things again, and it's possible that the economy can start to show a recovery in June. The question is whether that will be a real recovery. That is to say, we're going to go from, let's say, minus 5% GDP growth this quarter to, let's say, minus 6% in the first quarter, and then maybe in the second quarter it'll be minus 2%. In other words, it'll be bad but improving. If that's the case, then there's going to be a lot of optimism that the Fed and Treasury have been successful.
It's hard to envision that, maybe because it's so... the news is coming in is so bleak right now, and the warnings that are coming in, and And it seems that, as a matter of fact, I'll go so far as saying it seems it's getting quite worse. You know, look at the auto situation. You know, aside from the fact that it, you know, Congress is just, I don't know. I don't know if anybody has any respect for the entire process anymore, or maybe we should have more respect for the process because they're not making quick and just flipping decisions on this, something like this. But I will say that the auto situation, you know, if we do apply $14 billion, which is, by the way, miraculously there was $15 billion left in the TARP. I thought that was kind of cool. We had, you know, there was $15 billion left, and then maybe we're going to tap this at this point. If it does happen, we're talking about a month or so into next year that they seemingly will hold off until they have to fold, just in time for Obama to come in and his team, which he has declared that he will not let them go under. But really, at the same time, if we don't have sales, and I mean, what kind? We're still going to have, it seems, significant unemployment increases, you know, because of the whole automobile slowdown. And, you know, you see the mass layoffs increasing. And you saw last month's job revisions. I mean, we're seeing obviously something, you know, the BLS is not reported correctly for or the right amount for some time. And we saw that last report that they revised up by, what, another 500,000 for the preceding 2 months in total job losses. So, right. You know, we're not seeing any leveling off with this. But let me just get back to this. So now, if you want to take, let's say what I'm taking what you just told me. So I'm taking it as, I'm not really willing to go too bullish, but I'm not really willing to go too bearish at this point. But at the same time, it's a very murky outlook right now. So you have this this market letter you call, you know, John Markman's Trader Advantage. By the way, just a, you know,
strategic advantage.
Sorry about that.
I actually have two letters. One's called Strategic Advantage. That's for long-term investors, and I have a trading letter called Trader's Advantage.
Right, that's what I was actually. I thought you changed the name also. That's what I was looking at. The you know, you write, and I was mentioning to people, if you haven't started following John Markman, he gives some great insight. By the way, you get some great insight on Twitter, which is really great. If you could follow him, it's John J-O-N Markman. Twitter is, that's his Twitter name. I would recommend you follow him.
My Twitter name actually is J.D. Markman.
I get all this wrong, don't I, with you? I'm just making sure.
It's okay. J.D. Markman.
I'm trying to make you repeat it. That's Markman. Like a thing, the thing they did in the radio. Anyway, so here's the point. So I get your letter, and it's a great letter, and I encourage people to check it out. We'll put a link on the site to this. So, but you have long positions, obviously, in there, and yeah. I mean, what? Just generally speaking, so...
You know, I think that regardless of whether... The infrastructure project works in the long term or not. In the short term, people are going to think that it works, that it's going to work. So, from a sentiment point of view, I do want to be long. Going to get long the materials sector. You know, the easiest way to do that is through the security, the ETF with the symbol XLB. Mm-hmm. That's all the basic material stocks within the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
And by materials, I mean steel and cement and chemicals and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you committed to that, or is that something you're thinking about doing?
That's something that will be added soon.
Mm-hmm. I'd encourage you, by the way, to look in some of the engineering firms as well. We've actually made a big chunk of money. We had recommended for our portfolios ACM, and there's a couple of other ones. There's Michael Baker.
Like engineering firms, they've really had a hard time recently, so they're down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. The big international company I like is ABB out of Sweden and Switzerland, and of course Fluor out of Orange County, California, FLR, and Jacobs, JEC, and finally out of the Bay Area, there's a company called URS, symbol URS.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all pretty solid companies that will definitely be getting a good share of money from any infrastructure spending, because these are the companies that either engineer or manage the engineering of large infrastructure projects, whether they're airports or streets or dams.
So,
the steel makers, you know, steel is kind of a tough issue because, you know, while we are, you know, steel is in the international market now.
Mm-hmm.
And although the United States is spending money, wants to spend a lot of money on infrastructure, you know, there's a world market out there that is where steel is really not in demand, particularly in places where it was in hot demand before, like China. So I think, you know, while I believe steel could have a nice run going forward, I'm not making a huge bet on it. If I wanted to make a bet on it, I would buy Mittal Arcelor with the symbol MT.
Mm-hmm. You know, the one that we were looking at, a couple of them, you know, the play is if the automobile companies get this bailout, they're going to get a ride because a lot of them been knocked down, like AK Steel, which was knocked down dramatically.
Well, this is a really interesting thing about the auto bailout because, you know, they're really only asking for, let's say, a three-month bridge to the future.
Mm-hmm.
Do we really think that that the auto industry is going to turn itself around in 3 months?
I don't think they can turn themselves around in 3 years.
And they haven't been able to turn themselves around for you know, several years.
No,
it's really, I just feel bad about the auto industry because I think that as much as we all would love to save it, it may be beyond saving right now. I hope I get to eat those words in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, from a standpoint of pure capitalism, it would probably be better. We'd probably be better off allowing it to die, the U.S. auto industry to die, and declare Japan the victor. And then perhaps in a couple of years, some new U.S. entrepreneurs will put together an auto company and try again.
Let me skip over to something, because I agree with you, by the way, on the material side, because it appears to me that assuming you get some of the stocks right, and even if you just pick a sector play, that there is this, I don't know, $200, $300, $400, $500, a billion, you know, $1 trillion being put into the sector, you just got to get a rise on some of these. It's a natural problem. I mean, even if they only get a piece of it, it would seem that you'd get a decent rise. I mean, it's a lot of money going into that. So the other thing is, we listened to his radio address last week, and then we actually replayed it here. And he three of the points he talked about were the discussion of rebuilding or adding to the internet and the broadband and the information superhighway. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, who's the player there? I mean, you have some of the old line companies, maybe like a Juniper, maybe, do you think, or maybe even Intel or Cisco, or I mean, is there anything that you can really put your finger on in that regard that maybe have a Corning, for that matter, with fiber optics?
Yeah, I've recommended, I've had a buy for a couple of, about 3 weeks now on the global telecom sector.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about Verizon, AT&T, companies like that.
Uh-huh.
And I have an ETF name for you on that one, and I'll tell it to you in 1 minute. As far as the equipment makers are concerned, you know, there's a lot of equipment in the world right now.
Uh-huh.
And the industry has become so efficient that you need less and less of this equipment in order to make the internet structure work. So the equipment makers, although they should have a rise out of a very low level, I don't think they're going to be the best beneficiary of the new broadband bailout, if there is one.
Mm-hmm.
The ETF for the S&P Global Telecommunications is IX as in X-ray P, IXP.
I want to ask you something, and then I want to finish up. I do want to talk about, we'll talk about the money show, remind me, but I want to talk about Bernie Madoff for a second more. But I want to ask you about, you keep mentioning ETFs. I like ETFs as well. One of the theses of, that I developed months ago, nothing groundbreaking by any shakes, was that we have several problems with the markets. We have several problems with people not wanting to be in the markets, obviously. Mutual fund companies, traditional open-end mutual fund companies, T. Rowe Price, Franklin Resources, Lake Mason, we identified those three in particular, publicly traded, and we figured that they're going to have a really hard time in the future. And you add to the fact that realizing that we could pretty much get the proper exposure to any sector, broad-based or very, very, you know, finely tuned and honed and directed sector, by picking up an ETF, what's the future for, generally speaking, what's the future for mutual fund companies? Because I really don't understand the model anymore.
No, I hear you. I mean, the reason I can't tell you what the model for mutual funds is going into the future. I know that you have a great handle on that, Andrew, and I trust your judgment on it. But as far as ETFs are concerned, they're a very, very good way to capitalize on your directional belief about a particular industry or region. The one thing I want people to be very careful about with ETFs, though, is number one, most ETFs are market cap weighted. So the largest companies within those ETFs are the ones that make it go. So if you have a belief that, you know, that let's say small caps will be successful but large caps won't, and then you're using and then you're trying to capitalize on that belief through an ETF, like a sector ETF, you'll be disappointed.
Interesting.
The large cap. So you know, with an ETF, just like with an index, you're really making a bet on the top five or six names within that ETF. So I highly encourage people to look at the exact names, the exact companies that are at the top of the holdings list of the ETFs that they buy, and make sure that they feel comfortable about those exact companies, because that's what you're really buying.
Where's the best place to find that information that you like?
I use a website called ETFinvestmentoutlook.com.
Right. We'll put that up there too. If you click on the right side of that,
that website, ETFinvestmentoutlook.com. There's a symbol box on the upper right. Type in the symbol that you're interested in, and then on the right, and then on the page that comes up, you'll see a list of holdings, and they have the best list of holdings of ETFs I've ever seen.
I like this.
They have the top 25 or 30.
I like this. This is a nice site. I don't think I've seen this before. You know, I was looking at something this week. We were doing some.
Can I say one other thing about ETFs?
Yeah.
The new Ultra ETFs have become very popular. These are the ETFs that provide double or triple the exposure to a particular industry, sector, or region.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the word Ultra in their title.
Right.
So it's either you can get a double long or double short, or triple long or triple short exposure to a sector. What people really need to understand about these ETFs is that they only promise to give you a daily double long or daily double short. If you expect, you cannot expect to hold those double longs or double short ETFs for more than, let's say, a week and have it really accurately reflect what's happening in the market.
Well, that's interesting. That's exactly what I was going to ask you about, to be honest with you, because it's something interesting that's developing. We did a study recently of two of those in particular, and we're going to do some others, but if you look at the double short ETF for the S&P 500, which is symbol SDS, and you look at the double short, the double long ETF for the S&P 500, which is SSO, and if you plot them with a zero line, if you will, in terms of they theoretically should be inversely by two times, right? When one goes up, one go down, it should be equal. You know, it should, if you bought equal parts of those, in theory, if you bought equal parts, you should never have a gain or a loss, in theory, except for the management fee or whatever. What's interesting is that was the case for a while. In October, that totally changed. In October, we found that the short ETF outperformed the long ETF in terms relatively now, dramatically. And I find that very interesting. And I wonder if this
it would take a while to explain all the math involved here, but I'll give you the best example that I know of. If you look at FXI, which is the iShares for China, it's down 47% this year.
Right.
If you have exposure to Chinese stocks, beginning of the year till today, you're down 47%, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you own FXP, which is ProShares Ultra Short China, so you're supposed to have double the negative exposure. If you've held that all year, you're actually down more. You're down 53%.
Okay. Let me ask you something. How do I do this site? Because I'm not having luck here. I do FXP, right? FXI, excuse me.
Yeah.
Oh, I have to get back there here.
I was looking at stock charts.
Okay, because FXI doesn't have. I can't bring that up. It doesn't show me charts or anything, which is a little weird.
Looking at an ETF investment outlook.
Yeah.
No. I did this in stock charts.
Okay. So FXI. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So exactly. That's exactly the point. I see it right there. Yeah. So, are they going to try to bring that back to when things calm down? You would think they'll bring that back to zero. Is there an arbitrage opportunity? Have you thought about this?
No, all it promises to do is give you the daily double long or double short. That's all it's about.
Yeah, because they're adjusting their portfolio continually. One of the problems we saw with, I think it was EEV, symbol EEV. There was a time that they were trying to do the double short of the emerging markets, but in fact we saw their portfolio was loaded up with yen futures. It's very odd.
Yeah, well, I mean, the another one that to look at is, you know, the XLF, which is the financial stocks within the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
It's down 57% this year.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So theoretically, if you're double long that whole thing, that thing all year, you should be up like 100 and something.
Right. So that one,
the double short financials,
SKF,
is only up 23% this year.
Right. One of the problems they had was when the shorting happened, it got really wacky.
You know, it's just a math problem. I can explain it to you.
All right. No, well, let's not do that. But let's just finish up with this
All I want to tell people is that don't. If you want to express a very negative view on a particular sector and you want it to last a whole year, you know, buy an option, buy a leap. Don't buy the double.
We like the double longs just for a quick short. That's what I mean. A quick hedge. That's what we use them for.
And for a couple weeks, they're fine.
Exactly.
For anything longer than that, don't expect them to work the way you expect.
Exactly. Let me get into this Bernie Madoff thing because I think it's important that we talk about that very briefly, and then we'll call it quits here. So I guess the big issue is, do you think this is this whole thing, if you haven't heard about this, let's give you a quickie on this. A hedge fund manager out of New York, in the business for 30, 40 years, to some known as a pretty much a legend in what he's done, and had amassed a tremendous amount of money. One of the original, you know, board seat members of the NASDAQ had started it and was just amazing history with this gentleman. Seemingly, as he said, there was really only a Ponzi scheme that he somehow went through $50 billion, and there's a lot of questions related to really what's going on here. So that's the short version of that. John, is this, do you think, going to create a significant problem with the confidence for the, you know, all the way down to the average investor? Is this something that somebody who's listening has to worry about?
Well, I think it's something that we need to worry about in the sense that, you know, when people are investing in the market, they're expressing faith or confidence that they can trade their real assets, which in this case might be cash, or for a paper asset, which is either a stock or a bond, or, you know, in this case, a portion of a hedge fund. And to the extent that people believe that investment managers are crooked, you know, that can really undermine the market. And what the problem in this case is that the most important people in any economy, and I don't mean this to be, I don't want this to sound elitist or anything, but the most important people in an economy are the rich.
Mm-hmm.
They buy the most stuff.
Right.
And, you know, and we're talking about iPods or cars or houses or whatever. It's the rich who buy things.
Mm-hmm.
When you wipe out the rich, you have a really big problem because the velocity of money just slows to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that the rich might feel much more wary of all investment vehicles because of the apparent terrible acts of this one gentleman should be very frightening to people who are in the market.
Yeah, I was very surprised that this didn't get a lot more play.
I think it's a problem for the economy. When you wipe out rich people, you wipe out a lot of spending.
Mm-hmm.
It's also bad for the overall stock market because when you ruin people's confidence that whoever is going to be in charge of their money is going to, you know, act, you know, as a responsible fiduciary, you'll find people just retreating and putting their money into real assets, which is why, you know, I think actually gold can have a decent run going forward because people do continue to think that gold represents a store of value. And strangely enough, I think it could be a plus for real estate because although real estate, you know, obviously at its highs was a terrible investment, it's still something that people feel is going to be a tangible, serves as a tangible store of value.
Right.
especially at these lower levels. And I think they're going to see a real estate boom going forward.
So this news broke on Thursday evening, and it trickled through the news and all, but it didn't seem to have an effect on the markets, you know, moving throughout the day, although the markets were crazy because they were almost, you know, going to get, you know, I heard crazy people talking on Thursday evening about, you know, the worst is about to happen in the world, the worst we've ever seen. And obviously we saw Japan and Asia down and Europe down before Pelosi and, you know, some of the other folks there were, you know, suggesting that there could be a presidential pardon, I guess, instead of going through the Senate. Do you think, though, that this is going to start to pick up velocity here, or is it really something that will, is this something big that's going to happen, or is this something that's just going to be, like, lingering for a while?
The Madoff affair?
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting question, because you have to ask yourself, how much money was really involved? You know, he originally, if anybody asked him how much money he was managing, he would always say, oh, just a few billion.
Mm-hmm.
When the news broke, the fund was originally said to be $17 billion. But when he was taken into custody, he said the amount of money involved was $50 billion. I don't think we really know what the impact is going to be, because we don't really know how much money was involved. You know, we don't really know what exactly he was doing with this money or where it went. Was he just a really bad investor in a few hundred billion, you know, $300 million that he got in, he immediately put to work in the market and lost it? Or did he, when money came into his door, did he incinerate it? You know, we don't really know where this money went. And until we have a lot more answers as to, you know, what this scheme was all about, I don't think we're going to be able to judge its impact.
Well, I will tell you that the news is littered with information. It keeps coming out. It's all about Santander is disclosing a $3.1 billion exposure to his fund. The numbers keep on mounting here.
The reason that some of these banks are exposed is actually kind of interesting. People apparently believed that his fund was such a safe investment that they borrowed against their other holdings. Let's say, for instance, you were a real estate tycoon in Florida and sold your mall properties, let's say, for $100 million.
Mm-hmm.
And you had that safely ensconced at Goldman Sachs. Well, if you want to then buy stuff, Goldman would tell you, don't use your $100 million.
Right.
Borrow against it.
Right.
And so, borrow, you know, you don't need to use your money. You got to borrow against it.
Yeah, OPM. Other people's money.
Yeah, they would lend them money to go out and borrow stuff. And a lot of people would borrow against their real assets, whether it's, you know, like their own real estate or their other stock holdings, to put money into Mr. Madoff's funds. And I think that's where all these French and Spanish banks are coming in. They lent people money to get into his funds.
Pretty scary time, my friend. Pretty scary time. So let's wrap it up. And like I said, encourage. What's the best place for people to, aside from MSN Money, which you write so wonderfully and so accurately of late, especially, where can they go to check out your private client letter?
Yeah, there's two places to find my letters. Strategic Advantage, which comes out every day, is at markmancapital.net. That's markmancapital.net. And people can sign up for a free 2-week trial.
Mm.
And to get my trading letter, they can go to johnmarkman.com, johnmarkman.com, and they can see my my trading letter.
Right. Of course, follow them on Twitter. And also, I think, are you going to be in Orlando with me in a couple months, in February?
Yes, I'll be in Orlando, and Great. Look forward to I'll have probably 4 presentations. I'd love to meet people there.
Good. And hopefully this time we could hook up a dinner. I'm looking forward to go to Emeralds maybe with you. What do you think?
That'd be awesome.
Oh, good. All right, my friend, I'll talk to you soon. And really pleased that you could join us, and have a great new year.
And I hope you have a great new year too. And as
thanks.
I said in my last column for MSN, which was pretty bearish, I hope I'm 100% wrong and that we have a fantastic 2009.
Go market. I'm there. Thanks.
Okay.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Let's wrap on episode number 87. If you have any questions, of course, you can email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you want to take a tour of that 14-minute tour of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. See what's going on and how we do what we do and really how we invest for our clients on a real-time basis. It's a pretty cool presentation. Just go over to the Disciplined Investor. There's a link right there, and you could just click on it and take a look. And of course, if you have any questions or you want to talk, we're always here for you. I hope you have a safe week. Next week, we're going to have some great guests, and I look forward to speaking with you then. Have a great week. Be safe. Interesting things are going to happen, I'm sure. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.